Good morning and welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker, and we are signing in here once again on this Wednesday morning in Atlanta. Biz Rocket Radio is an opportunity for us to chat with executives and business owners here in the Atlanta area, get some insights from them as to how business is going, some of the challenges that they've gone through, and certainly some of the successes that they've had. This morning, we have two guests with us from Liquid Strategies, and they are going to be talking to us about business transition. Certainly happy to have you guys in, so welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
So Michael Shannon is our first guest, and Michael is a managing principal for Liquid Strategies here in the U.S. Michael, maybe you could give us a little bit of background on yourself and kind of how you got to where you are now.
Sure. Yeah, well, I'll just give you the quarter version since we've got a little bit of time.
Okay.
Originally from the Northeast, up in Massachusetts, and ended up in Atlanta in the late 70s.
Go Pats.
Thank you. And oh, I've adopted the Falcons now.
Though. Oh, have you really?
Absolutely.
That's good. I'm still a Redskins fan, diehard. I lived in D.C.
Okay.
too long.
Yeah, well, 6-0 is a good start this year.
That is a pretty good start. It brings a lot of bandwagon fans anyway.
Absolutely. So moved here, as I said, in the late 70s. I met my wife, Cynthia, and just celebrated our 29th wedding anniversary. And
wow.
Just back from a two-week holiday in Thailand, so I'm still a little bit jet-lagged, so you have to... Hopefully, I won't be nodding off here during the interview.
I will try and keep you awake.
Okay, great. Thanks. So anyway, I've got two wonderful sons out of our wonderful marriage, and two aspiring young graduates that we've just launched into the world. So we've got a budding architect up in New York living in Brooklyn, and we've got a budding film actor in Los Angeles.
Really?
So the artistic side of the family, I have to give to my wife. So
I was going
to
say the business side.
She gets credit for that. So they're not great on finances just yet, but
you're going to get them there. Right?
Hopefully, some of that will rub off.
That's right.
But anyway, so son of an Air Force family, grew up all over the East Coast, and parents settled in the Orlando area, which is where I went on to undergraduate school, University of Central Florida. At the time I went there, it was about 5,000 students, and for those who don't know, it's about 50,000 today, and yeah. I think the second or third largest university in the U.S. today.
Right outside Orlando, right?
Just outside Orlando, correct. So I moved up here after undergraduate school and started in the banking industry. My first job was with Citizens Southern National Bank. For those of your listeners who remember that far back when there was state banking laws, and CNS was one of the largest banks in the state and a huge $3 billion bank. So think about that not that long ago when $3 billion was a large size.
And not too big to fail nowadays, right?
Yes, that's true. That'd be a rounding error, I think, on all the banks today. And but the banking industry was a great place to start a career. It really was. I learned about risk. I learned about risk assessment, how to make loans. And then the influx of the New York and Money Center banks that came to Atlanta in the early 80s, recruited me away, and during that period of time, I got my MBA at Georgia State and started working in larger transactions, first Bankers Trust of New York, and then spent some 6 years with Citibank in the leverage buyout side of things, large structured finance. Again, all these types of positions helped to give me an understanding of businesses, small business, medium size, and large business. And what worked and what didn't, what strategies worked, what didn't, why was one successful, why was one not. And that kind of took us up to the 1991 recession, when, if you recall, during that time, there's about 100,000 jobs lost in Wall Street, and it really wasn't a good time to be in. The go-go days of banking were kind of officially over, during that recession. And so I found, started looking around and found a great opportunity with what I used to call a sleepy little company on Peachtree Street that was called Retail Credit at the time, and AKA Equifax. So at about a $1 billion company at the time, and joined them in early 1992. And little did I know that would start almost a 20-year career. And had a wonderful run there until just recently, and was involved in a lot of the growth at Equifax. And that's where a lot of my learnings have come from in terms of my international experience and the different types of businesses that we did, the international expansion. When I first came in, I headed up the corporate finance business for Equifax and later ended up running international development, helping to set the strategy to get Equifax into 10 new countries in 4 continents. Ran the global M&A business as well, and that's where Mark and I first hooked up. Mark came in and worked with us on the M&A side and eventually took over running mergers and acquisitions for a period of time. So after probably about 10-year stint on the corporate side of things, I got very involved in running businesses. First in Asia Pacific, back around 2000, then was seconded to the UK, based in London, and ran first the UK business and then all of the European businesses for about 5 years. So that was a great opportunity once again to expand on my international experience that covered Latin America, Asia, and now Europe, and then moved back to the U.S. About 5 years ago and started yet another new business for Equifax, which was the commercial solutions business, a B2B opportunity to sell credit services and solutions into the small business community. So that all gave me the background, if you will, and the impetus, if you will, to go out on my own. I left a couple years ago. And how we got to Liquid Strategies is right after I left Equifax, I started looking for my next chapter and how we would define what I would be interested in doing to take all of my experiences and put them together into some capacity to help small business, medium-sized businesses. Because one of the things that we learned was that what was missing as a common ingredient in a lot of these businesses is a very coherent strategy. They might have the small business owner or medium-sized business might have a good goal or an objective in mind, and they knew what they wanted to do, but perhaps everyone else didn't. And getting everybody on the same page and a clearly articulated strategy was kind of a missing link. So during that period of time of looking for how I would do this, I started working in collaboration with one of my former colleagues in London, a guy by the name of John Saunders, who I had brought into the company to help me to turn around one of my businesses in the UK. And he had launched a business called Liquid Strategies. And together we looked at a couple of buy-side opportunities in Europe. And we looked at working with private equity, which has been always a great partner for us in our business. And we came very close to buying a company in Europe that was in the data and information business. But as you know, on the buy side, it's like a crapshoot. You know, you get maybe 1 in 100, at best. And that really didn't seem to be where I wanted to spend my time, if you will, on such a long shot, looking at buy side opportunities. And so that really was the birth of Liquid Strategies in the U.S. is John and I got together, wrote our business plan, and decided to launch the concept of working on the strategy side, the capital fundraising, and what we call corporate venturing, and put that into a business at the beginning of, or actually at the end of last year.
So when you were overseas,
yes,
which was seems to be a good bit of your development in terms of with Equifax, and this is a little bit off topic, but you got two kids, married. Clearly, they're with you, traveling all over the place,
all over the world.
How are you able to make that work, and how did that impact kind of the family and the dynamics? And I mean, there's so much that goes on with that, with people nowadays moving and adjusting to the professional life that they're trying to follow, but their family's got to kind of go with them.
No, that's right. And I think first of all, having the family support is a big factor behind every successful international business person's career. Without having that support of family, it's really going to be quite difficult. I love to tell the story. My kids were 13 and 15 when we moved them to Europe. And wow. my 15-year-old was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He was really excited about going. And
we would have been like a freshman in high school at that point, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
And my 13-year-old was the worst thing that ever happened. How could I pull him out of school, take him to a foreign country? And then when he had a comeback, if you will, he was 18.
Yeah.
And I ruined his life a second time by making a move when he was 18. So, but our kids have always been flexible. I mean, gosh, we took them traveling. I've been to more than 50 countries. Took our son to China when he was 6 months old. The kids have been very adaptable and have been and visited probably, gosh, at their age, many, many more than we could ever think that we had that exposure when we were in our teens. So I think it was, and it is, the assignments are what you make them to be, too. If you go in expecting another country is going to be just like America, then you're probably not going to be happy. If you go into a new country, whether it's Asia, Latin America, whether it's Europe, experience the goodness that country has to offer, the differentness, make that a positive, use that as a learning opportunity for you to grow and develop, both personally and professionally. And that was the attitude that we took. And I think, you know, we're one of those that had a successful expat part of our career and then repatriated back into the community, which they say, and Mark will have a view on this too, as a former expat, is one of the harder things to do, is the repatriation side. You come back, and we came back to the same country, the same city, as a matter of fact, and the same company.
Yeah.
So it helped in that transition, but you know, you're different. You're different when you come back, and you do have to have that assimilation process.
Yeah. Neat growth. Great experience for them, I'm sure. Yeah. During it may have been complicated and difficult, but it sounds like certainly a wonderful educational experience for them.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that, John. And it's amazing now how connected these kids are. I call them kids even if they're young 20s.
Yeah.
You know, they have those relationships from school abroad that they keep up with. And it's such a small world now that, you know, with Facebook and the internet and everybody's connected, they stay connected, and they think nothing of going to work for an internship in Shanghai or, you know, going to Istanbul for the summer or going to Greece for a holiday. I mean, it's just a world that's very different than it was maybe 30 years ago.
But I think it's that experience that broke down those walls for them in being able to know that, hey, I can go to another country and assimilate and figure out what to do and how to do it. And whether it's this country or that country, it's just, it's all the same.
Yeah. Now, and the kids are amazingly adaptable. You know, you can stick them on an airplane and fly them to Tokyo, and they know how to get through the airports, get through customs, and, you know, they do fine. And, you know, we're all worried about it, but, you know, they just do fine. So I think it's good for anybody to give their kids that kind of exposure.
Yeah, great stuff. So I'm going to come back in just a second. We're going to get a little bit more on the company.
Sure.
Next I want to introduce our other guest, and that's Mark Borelli. Mark is a principal here at Liquid Strategies and a professional radio guest.
I wouldn't go that far.
All right. Well seasoned and experienced in that. So welcome in, Mark.
Thank you very much, John.
So, Mark, you are not been in the United States your whole career either. And, in fact, I think grew up in a different area.
Yeah, I'm definitely a foreigner. I like to say I'm more southern than anybody here. I was born in South Africa. There are a lot of South Africans now in Atlanta. And there are actually South Africans all over the world. We're kind of like the boat people. But I grew up there. I went to high school in Switzerland. And that was a defining moment, I think, for me, because I went to a small school halfway up an Alp, 250 students, 50 nationalities.
Wow.
And so got exposed to people from all over the world and became very comfortable with dealing with people from different countries and understanding more of how they see the world. And I think that opened my eye up and has been one of my successes in business. I think also going to Michael's point about traveling and kids' adaptability, as a kid, you only know what you know. You have no benchmark to measure it against. And as I joke, by the time I was 21, I'd lived in 22 homes, 3 countries, 8 schools, and I can't think how many cities. And I just thought that was normal. That's what everybody did.
Right.
And so, you know, and flying at the age of 13 when I first went to school in Switzerland, it used to take me 16 hours to get home. You know, it was a flight from Switzerland to London, London to Johannesburg, Johannesburg to Port Elizabeth, and there was no support for kids in those days. They just threw you on a plane and let you go.
They didn't have like a bracelet or a tracking device or anything on you, you know.
Good luck. Sure they had passport.
Oh, no, you cannot leave the seat until I come get you. And, you know, you got to, sign and retina test and everything.
You just
go.
You just went and you just got on. So I think that gave me a lot more confidence in international life and how to deal with people and be flexible. And I think it's, as Michael says, and I was totally supportive, anybody should do it. But don't go expecting Rome. You know, when you're in Rome, it's Rome and it's not home. But so I did that. I finished school in Switzerland. I went to university in England and did my undergraduate work there. I left there and traveled around the world for about a year. I went all through Asia and Russia and China before the Soviet wall came down. And then I came to graduate school in the States. I went to Tulane in New Orleans and spent 4 years enjoying New Orleans and got a law degree and an MBA.
And then enjoying New Orleans.
Enjoying New Orleans, yes. And it was an interesting city to go to graduate school, I think.
Yeah.
I've always said, you know, and plugging my own school, but if you get somebody out of Tulane with an A as an undergraduate, you know they've committed because that city has more distractions than most places. Anyway, and then I left there and I went to work in London. I got an opportunity. This was the late 80s to go and work for an investment bank in London. It was a small investment bank that doesn't exist anymore like many. And I did all sorts of capital markets work. I did hostile and friendly takeovers, public offerings, buy and sell companies. I think the only one anybody would have ever heard of here is I was involved in the first IPO of Manchester United before the Glazers got involved. And I think back then we took it public.
That's
and
a football team, John.
Real football.
Real football.
That's right. And I think when we took it public in 1989, 1990, it had a market capitalization of 60 million pounds, say $100 million. And I think the Glazers were just taking it for a couple of billion. So it's changed a lot since then. Anyway, so I did that. And then in 93, my ex-wife persuaded me to move to Atlanta. She was from here. And so I came here. I joined Holiday Inn Worldwide before it became IHG. Okay. And did strategic planning for Europe, Middle East, Africa, Asia Pacific, and did hotel deals in Asia Pacific and the U.S. And then in 97, I joined Michael at Equifax and worked under him on global M&A. And then when Michael left to run a few businesses, they put me in charge of that, and I did that until about 2000, 2001. And then after that, I worked with one or two boutiques, investment banking boutiques, and then started a firm in 2004. And going to Michael's point, you know, what I learned at Equifax was companies that came for sale weren't ready for sale. They didn't have strategies. They hadn't thought through things. They made statements that were incorrect. And then, you know, typically you had a small business owner who ran a successful business. But as I usually say, they are good at one of two things. They either invent something or they can sell very well, or they do the combination of both, which means their sell side's fantastic, their product's usually good, and their customer knowledge is fantastic. Their finances are usually a mess. Their HR is non-existent. Their legal's a disaster. And it's just, it has no...
Other than that.
Yeah. Other than that, it's a great company.
But that is of no interest to them, so they pay it no attention.
Right.
When they come to sell, they go out with the good stuff, which attracts buyers. And then, you know, and I learned this from my Equifax days. I think under Michael's leadership, and when I was at Equifax, we had one of the best due diligence teams you could put together. And we would go in, we could tear a company apart in a week.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this company that they thought was worth X was suddenly worth a quarter X because we found all these problems in the back end. And so I realized people really needed help on that. Yeah. And it was just all that structure. So you had to put in a strategy and a process, but you also had to fix the back end structure and get it tied up. And then also, finally, with the strategy side, you know, one of the things I love about strategy is people have strategies and mission statements. But then when you look at what they measure, it doesn't correlate at all. And the most classic example, I think, is a law firm in town whose claim that their strategy is to, and their mission is to provide best customer service. But the only thing they measure is hours worked by partners, which the two have no connection whatsoever. So you have no idea how you're doing against your strategy. And so that's where, so Michael and I have talked about this for the years. And when he started Liquid Strategies, we talked about working together on this and using my experience on the M&A side and small companies and his experience in the bigger corporate side, and then how we could help these people.
Perfect. Well, let's talk a little bit about the company. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that you guys specialize in. I mean, is it a, clearly you're helping business owners with the liquidation or purchase of a company. Are you guys working more on the buy side or on the sell side?
Yeah, well, let's sort of just talk about the three prongs of Liquid Strategies.
Great.
And the three types of services. So, you know, the first one is, you know, we classify ourselves as more of a boutique corporate advisory firm. So the advice, if you will, or the advisory could come across a number of different ways. So the classic strategy assignment or company is looking to redefine their strategy or to develop an executable strategy. And this is one of the things that, you know, typically in a small business or even a medium-sized business, that there's not a lot of attention paid to that. So what we would like to do is to come in there and really do a strategic review of the business. You know, work with the CEO, try to understand what his objectives are, what his timelines are. So there may or may not be a, quote, what we would call corporate finance transaction associated with the project. It may be help us to expand this product line. It may be this is our problem. We're trying to get into this market. We don't know how to do that. Or we're looking to develop an international component to the strategy because we're primarily U.S. domestic today. And so the roles could take on a number of different elements. And because we operate as a partnership-based firm with offices in two different countries, but we also have a virtual team of senior advisors across different industries. And we'll talk about the industry sectors in just a minute, but just still on the services themselves. So sort of classic corporate strategy advisory, our thought process is you know, once we can define the strategy, know where the company's trying to do, help them to put a plan together to really connect the dots, something that's actionable, measurable. These are the kinds of things that our corporate backgrounds have really helped us to see through that many of middle market type companies don't do a really good job with. So now if there's a if there's the thought that I'm bringing you in to help us to prepare for a sale, then that's a different type of engagement as well.
Right.
And in some cases, if you're in early, and we'll give some examples in a few minutes, if you're in early with a company helping them on the strategy, over the course of that relationship, there's going to be opportunities for them to now think about how are they going to fund their growth strategy. It's all well and good to say that I want to expand in these three countries, I want to expand my product line, I want to acquire this company or that company, so how are you going to fund it? Well, I mean, we're kind of perfectly positioned at that point in time between Mark and myself, you know, my banking background, the buy-side experience between Mark and I think over 4 years, did about 100 acquisitions at Equifax. So we know how to buy companies.
Right.
Selling companies is a little bit different. Selling companies. But having the buy-side experience, having the risk assessment experience, having the strategy background, really understanding what makes that company tick, and we'll really tear through it to make sure we really understand if they want to go through a sale process, what it is they're selling. You know, what are their assets? What is their value proposition? What's their competitive advantage? So in that particular case, we'll work with the company and either help to solicit if it's just a capital raise in terms of they're looking for institutional investors to come in at that point in time, or if it's really a sale, all or in part. And you know, that's where I think Mark's experience is very complementary in the Liquid Strategies business because of his sell side representing companies over 10 years after he was on the buy side for so long. He was buy side at Holiday Inn, he was buy side at Equifax. Now he really works a lot more on the sell side, and so we know how to help prepare companies for sale.
So because that buy side experience just sounds like it's invaluable in terms of preparing somebody that is going to be on the sales side, because you say, look, I know what they're going to be looking for.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right? So
absolutely.
What are some of the things that they're looking for, Mark?
I think going to Michael's point, I think the key things people are looking for is, one, what is your sustainable competitive advantage? Most companies can't even tell you when you ask them, but what is it that differentiates you from the competition on an ongoing basis?
Right.
I think second is, people always talk about profits, and while that's important, I think the next thing is the management team, the quality and depth of the management team, and how involved are they in the plan. So what we often come across is somebody will say to us, oh, I have a great management team, and they'll tell us about all these people. And you say, okay, and you hear about it, and then you say, well, who negotiates every contract with your customers? And the owner will say, I do. And do your management team see the financials? No, I keep those all to myself. And do they know how profitable each project is? No, that's kept to me. So really, you don't have a management team. You have a bunch of people who do what you tell them. And you don't run a company. You have a job.
Right.
And you cannot sell a job. And so those are key things. So you've got to have a good quality management team. You have to have a good strategy that's laid out and executable and measured and actionable. And then you have to have a sustainable competitive advantage. And I think those are the three key things. The rest is, you know, the rest falls out of those. I think your performance will fall out if you have those things. But without those, you're not very attractive. Because
you could put all that together in terms of calling it a coherent strategy as well. So having that strategy underpinning the results of the company historically, because that's going to speak for itself, but the buyer is looking for, so what are we going to do over the next 3 to 5 years? How am I going to create value? What can I do? Do the management team come with us? Does not? Do they have succession planning in place? You know, what are they going to need to implement their plan? Is it going to be a buy and invest? Is it just taking the shareholders out? Are the shareholders staying in the deal? So there's a lot of factors that get involved in that. But again, so going back to the three components of the business, so we've got the corporate advisory strategy work, we've got the sell side, if you will, or capital fundraising. And then the last part of what Liquid Strategies does is what we call corporate venturing. Corporate venturing to us is a way to help the management team, and this is where the size of the company could be very, very large. And in many cases, on those examples that we've got or that we've worked with, corporate venturing is generally, for us, been working with larger divisions of public companies that want to do something more entrepreneurial but are trapped within the context of a large company that's either capital constrained, constrained by the chase after the stock price, the quarterly earnings call, where they can't afford to take significant dilution or to do something maybe a bit more entrepreneurial. So we've been involved in fact, actively involved in two such companies. These are both UK-based that are, FTSE 100 companies or their equivalent that are looking to do something very entrepreneurial. So we've been involved in helping them with their business planning at the division level for a couple of their larger assets. And at the same time, they recognize that if they could take this off balance sheet, bring in some additional investors, and help to grow an aspect of the business outside of their corporate umbrella, still have a major investment in that and can reap the benefits of that, that could be a win-win.
Right.
And so that's kind of the third dimension, if you will. So we bring ideas like that to the private equity community that we particularly have a relationship with a company that says, we've got this company that we've been working with, and it seems to me you've got this secret sauce, they've got this secret sauce, and we can marry the two of you up, we could have a home run on both sides and still try to help the company meet its corporate objectives.
Now, I know you guys started out of England, right?
We did.
The organization did.
Yes,
And then you expanded here in the United States.
Yes.
Is there expectations or plans for expansion beyond that?
Yes, absolutely, John. And now we're still early into the process, so we've done a lot so far, I think. So again, going back to the history, 2008 is when John launched in the UK, and then I guess he would say we rebranded and relaunched at the end of last year with a new business philosophy and a much more buttoned down approach to the market. So we opened up in the U.S. in September of 2011. Mark joined in early part of this year and brought with him his relationship in business with CFA, which is Corporate Finance Associates, which is one of the oldest established middle market investment banks in the country. So we've got a strong relationship with CFA, and that's been part of our expansion in the U.S. At the same time, we recognize that being European-based, not everything's in London. I mean, everything just seems to go through London as the financial capital of at least Europe, if not the world. But we also recognize that Germany is a very important market. And so we've been in discussions with some former business colleagues of mine in Germany, and we'll be adding a German connection, if you will, to Liquid Strategies team before the end of the year, well into negotiations there. Can't really announce it at this point in time. And then we've already established a relationship with a firm, a former Bain spinoff, if you will, and another former colleague of mine in Italy. So we've got a strong connection to a company called VVR in Italy. And then, as I mentioned, I just got back from a couple weeks in Asia. Very, very keen on Asia. We think that's going to be a great market for Liquid Strategies. If you kind of take Asia simplistically, if you will, humor me for a minute. You said there's Northern Asia and there's Southern Asia. Okay, so just in terms
we'll leave
of thinking,
all the other lines.
Well,
just in terms
of making it easy to conceptualize this huge continent, right? The Northern Asian markets are extremely well developed. Korea, Japan, obviously second largest economy, and then I think with China still not very difficult opening up to Western investment and the rules and restrictions and the laws. Not as developed as they are in other countries, but then you've got 8 or 10 countries in Southeast Asia that have already had several cycles of boom bust. But the new free trade zone that has just been announced, so come effective in 2014, bringing together the Southeastern Asian countries is going to be a very, very large area for expansion and investment over the next 5 to 10 years. And so we've got our eyes set on that particular area of the world, and we've already got established contacts there and another very good contact in India if we choose to expand there. So crawl, walk, and run. We're still crawling and walking a little bit. But I do think that there is a tremendous runway for our type of business, if you will, because we fly under the radar of the big guys. I'm sure all the big guys, all the BCGs, the McKinseys and the Bains and the like. That's not our market. We're not in the Fortune 500 calling on CEOs. We're very much in the middle market side, private equity-based companies. Or if we do work, with the larger, you know, Fortune 1000, Fortune 500 companies or FTSE, you know, 200 companies, it's at the division level. It's not at the CEO level with the large companies who rightfully so want to use a much larger organization.
But I think is that going to be more on the corporate venture kind of side? Is that mainly where you'd be working with those larger groups?
We have, and we've also looked at doing some division strategy work though. Right. So not just on the corporate venturing.
Okay, Mark.
I think going back to Michael's point about international, you know, he talked about the opportunities, and with Michael's international experience in mind, I think one of the key things for American companies as they look to go abroad, and my experience with it is America's great strength, in a way, its great failing, is its legal system. We have a very good legal system. We have good courts. And so most American CEOs turn to their general counsel and they say, is this agreement safe? Can I sign it? And is this okay? And that's all that they worry about. However, once you get out of the U.S., and especially as you go more east or south, things don't work quite so well. And so when you get into China, Korea, Southern Asia, even parts of Brazil, it's suddenly no longer, even though Brazil does have good court systems, it's not about the documents. The documents are really an irrelevance. Hmm. And these people want to build a relationship with you because they know that when push comes to shove and there's an issue, can they work with you to resolve it, because they don't have time to try and get it through a court system because the courts don't work or it doesn't work as well.
Right.
And so what we have found in our experience is most Americans rush in, try and get a document signed and rush out, never spending time on the relationship, and then they wonder why the deal goes bad.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we are very fixated on time in this country. The classic story that shows it is, you know, the negotiations about Vietnam, where the Americans flew in and checked into the best hotel in Paris. The North Vietnamese took us a one-year rental on a house.
Right.
And they spent the first 6 months negotiating the shape of the table. They will take longer to do things. And what we can bring to people who are looking to expand these markets is an understanding of the cultural difference. Because at the end of the day, no matter what we do, it's about people. You know, people will make it work or people will make it fail. So can we, and I think so that's where our experience, not only putting the strategy together, but bringing a cultural knowledge that most people here don't have and don't appreciate. You know, and if you're CEO of a $500 million company in the U.S. and you fly over to Korea to talk to a guy who runs a $20 million company there, you know, he thinks he's your equivalent, and you can't go around telling him he's not, because your company's bigger, and you have to treat him as an equal and understand his cultural issues. So that's where I think we add a lot of value for people looking to go overseas. And Michael's Liquid Strategy already has one client looking to expand into Europe, and they're providing a strategy on how to do that. And I think that's going to be a bigger part of the offering.
Do you see that really as your niche in terms of working with companies that want to look at expanding and getting that cultural understanding of how do you do business in the Middle East, or how do you do business in Asia or Europe, and they just aren't really familiar with it?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a niche. It's certainly a competitive differentiation to be able to have that as a service, if you will, to have that experience. All the principals in Liquid Strategies have lived and worked abroad in more than one country, and so we're connected, if you will. And we talked about the kids being connected globally. You know,
we
do a pretty good job as well on the business side, staying involved. So. But there's not, you know, certainly there'll be many, many countries that we don't have that expertise. You know, we don't have a strong following in some of the Eastern European countries or even in Africa. Mark would certainly be connected to South Africa. But there is a lot of places that we wouldn't profess to be able to help companies. But certainly going through the thought process, I mean, we're a strong believer in the whole concept, Chris Zook's model of it, you know, when he wrote his books, and Profit from the Core and Beyond the Core, and how do you identify that competitive advantage and making sure that you're really pulling all that you can from the core? But the whole concept of beyond the core is looking at adjacencies.
Right.
And part of those adjacencies in the strategy work is looking at new markets. And so it's very typical for a U.S. company to want to go to the English-speaking countries, right?
Sure.
So we
got
those covered. So we're pretty knowledgeable in Canada, believe it or not. It's a foreign country, and you know, there's still some expansion there. And then certainly the U.K. and the members of the Commonwealth, and Australia is always on people's minds. So, but when you get into, you know, the Indias and the Chinas, I think Mark's bring up a very good point. In many cases, the documents aren't the main point. They're more of a suggestion, if you will, because the legal system is not quite as
basic outline.
Yeah, it's an outline. It's you know, it's not quite as pedantic as it is here. So it's the relationship that will drive the success of that partnership. And we've done joint ventures. Everyone on our team has done joint ventures in many countries, and we know what it takes to be successful. And having resources on the ground and, you know, again, unlike a traditional consulting firm, we don't just help develop the strategy and say, you know, we'll see you next year. you know, we'll work with them through the implementation. If they, in two of the cases we've got now on these UK expansions, the company now has asked us to assist them to get the business up and running. So we'll stay with them through the process and try to help them to, you know, monetize that investment in terms of their expansion.
How early does a company need to be thinking about a sale? How early do they need to really be strategizing about that? And when do they need to be bringing somebody on like you?
Excellent question. I'm going to let Mark take the first. He's been doing this. This is his area of specialty. I've got my views, but you know, I know it's going to be as early as possible. But Mark, why don't you've got some great examples.
I would typically say there are two things, and I'm going to steal two quotes. One is, if your company is not growing, you should sell it and go play golf. And two, if you're not getting at least...
Or something.
Or something.
If you're not getting somewhere between 10 and 15% return on your company, you should sell it.
Unless it's a lifestyle. I mean, if it's a lifestyle business, right, and it's a recognized lifestyle business, and we all know companies like that, right? I mean, they're in it just to support their lifestyle. At some point in time, though, they want to monetize that.
Right,
in looking at their estate planning, and that's why if you're looking at the aging of America and you look at where small businesses are today, and there's 25 million small businesses, and many, many, many of those have, you know, employees of less than 10, you know, they don't have somebody to leave it to. You know, is it a lifestyle business or not? Is it a sustainable business? Is there strategic interest in it? Is there interest from private equity, from venture capital? I mean, all these things have to be worked through. And in many cases, they haven't even broached those types of issues.
But I think going back to the original question, how soon should you look at it? I would say probably 3 years. Just to go back to the sale of a company, as I always tell people, if we were hired today to sell a company, it's probably going to take somewhere between 6 months at the very short end to a year, just depending on, you know, to get in, prepare all the documents, go out, market it, sell it, negotiate it, close it. So that's a year. And you need to be ready before that. So let's go back 3 years. So we would come in, going back to my earlier comments about, you know, helping people put processes in place, help people clean up the back office. The thing about these things, I've had one CEO say to me, but why does it take 3 years? You know, can't you come in and do this in a month? Yeah, I could. The problem is, you know, you have a fully operational business. The more disruption I create, the more likely it's going to come off the rails.
Right.
And the other thing is you have to keep growing your business, seeing your customers, and you can't give up a month or 2 months full time to work with me to get it cleaned up. So the longer we have, A, we can do it in a slow, managed way, and we can measure it as we improve it to make sure we're going down the right road. Because not everything, you know, some of it we don't know, but we're trying things. The other thing I try and explain to CEOs, you know, they say to you, what's this going to cost? And we give them an expense item. And they say, well, I don't think that's worth it. And I keep saying to them, you know, let's just keep some simple numbers. Let's say we say we're going to charge them $50,000 to put all this process in place and clean it up. If that $50,000 gives you $50,000 extra in profit and you're going to get a 5x multiple on it, the return's pretty good.
Yeah.
Even though cash flow for the year, it may not work out, but you know, you're going to get a huge return on sales. So you can't look at it just as what is it going to cost me now?
Right.
And finally, you know, one of the things we try and tell companies too is, and just diverting slightly, as Michael said, a lot of these small businesses, their lifestyle. People always think of death as this horrible thing. And I say, and I don't mean to belittle death, but death's not the worst thing. You know, if somebody dies, you grieve, you pass on, there's insurance, people get on. What really will damage a small company is if the owner goes out and does a Christopher Reeve. One day you're fine, the next day you're crippled, and you're seriously ill, and you're in hospital, so your family is distracted looking after you, your business's leadership, and that asset that has supported the lifestyle starts to deteriorate. And by the time they come around to figure out they should sell it because there's nobody to run it, it's lost a lot of value. Yeah. And so often I say to people, you know, get your company ready for sale. And even though you want to keep it in the family for the next four generations, you should always have it ready for sale because you don't know what tomorrow brings.
Right, right. Good point. Good point. Well, we are wrapping up on time here. One of the things that I wanted to kind of close with is a pearl of wisdom. So what would you leave our listeners with as a pearl of wisdom? Michael, start with you.
Okay, well, you know, certainly I don't believe in magic or silver bullets, but I do think that having the core strategy defined in your business, and we didn't really talk about the sectors, but we're really focused on B2B, on the business services sectors, particularly data, information, payments, technology-enabled firms, software companies. And again, in many cases, the CEO or the leader of that business has a great vision, and maybe there is a pretty good mission statement, and maybe even they have a value proposition, but they haven't really linked it all. And what we like to think of is putting all this together and what's typically Kaplan and Norton would call a balanced scorecard. And so putting this process in place and having it all linked with a coherent intelligence strategy that is easily communicated to the outside world, whether it's investors or your family,
right,
or your employees, and having all them having the ability to articulate that back down the line is so key. That's really half the battle. Execution, of course, is the other half of the battle. But if you can't define the strategy and it's not communicated and it's not very well understood, then it's very difficult to measure and hold somebody accountable for it. And it's amazing how many companies we'll go in and talk to, and a lot of these are small businesses, okay? I'm not talking about the large public companies. But and ask them, well, what is your strategy? And, well, can I see the document? Or is it written down? Or is it, no, they just have an idea or a vision. And so that's kind of one of my pet peeves, if you will, is to, you know, let's just focus on and how you can articulate that, make sure it's clearly written and understood and followed, and then it's something that, you know, people can define later, if you will, and that's really going to help companies like us come in there and help them to tweak it, to refine it, or to help position them, if you will, for representation on the outside in order to raise money.
So, I mean, that clear, definable mission statement, really what you're all about and how to describe that to others.
Yeah, and the mission statement is just part of it, right? So you'll start with a vision, then you'll define your mission, and then bring in that all to, so how are we going to do that now?
Yeah, okay.
So that's the how-to.
Yep.
How are we going to realize our goals and objectives? Here's our vision. Here's our goals and objectives. It may be, I'll ask somebody, what's your strategy? They say, well, I want to double the size of the business in the next 5 years. Well, how are you going to do it? Well, I'm going to increase sales. Well, I'm going to hire more salespeople. Well, that's not really a strategy.
Right.
You know, those are some specific tactics. So you have to have a way to link all this together in a strategy piece that shows the tactics, that not just the goals or the objectives. And so it's the how to do this and have an agreement within the management team so we're all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a baseball team.
Perfect. Thank you. That's great. Mark?
Well, quickly, I was actually thinking of Pearl of Wisdom. I think mine is going to be considered sacrilegious in the America, but I truly believe this.
Here we go.
I think
the wheels are off.
That every owner, or at least CEO, should take off, if they can, 2 weeks a year and get away from the business, because too many I meet are in the trees. They can't even see the forest.
Yeah.
They're just swamped with the day-to-day demands of the business. And so when you ask them about strategy and things, they can't even think strategically. They're just so busy fighting fires every day.
Yeah.
And what I say to them is, if that's what you're doing, you really just have a job and you're not driving a company. So, you know, and I'd say the only time you can do that is to get away. You need to turn off the BlackBerry, go away, let your brain unwind, and it'll be amazing what starts to float up through the subconscious.
Yeah.
And when they do that, they come back and they actually realize some of the stuff they've been worrying about on a daily basis is not important.
Hmm.
And really, what is going to drive their business to the next level? And if you can get them out of their day-to-day environment, I mean, often when we talk to them, it's like, we don't want to meet you in your office because there are too many distractions. You got to go somewhere else and think. And we're just so flooded with constant data, and people don't have time to think. So my pearl of wisdom is take time off and just let your brain do what it does really well, thinking quietly. And often that helps you see where you have to go, and we can help you get there. But if you don't know where you're going, we can't create it for you. We have to kind of help you on that.
Good stuff. So contacts, if somebody wants to reach out to you guys, what's the best way to get in contact? Michael, what's
yeah,
yours?
Well, we can certainly go onto the website and get all of our contact details there. But, you know, I'm based here in Atlanta. I've got an office in Midtown and have an office at my house as well. And so I jostle between the two, but usually I'm with the clients and on the road. I spend about half of my time in the U.K., about 4 or 5 trips each year, and most of our client, not most of it, we have a fair number of clients based in the UK, and
mm-hmm.
but we're very accessible. You know, I can give you an email address if you'd like.
Best way to contact you.
I think the best way then would be the email at michael.shannon@liquidstrategies.com.
Okay. Thank you much. Mark?
I'm not going to give you my email because most people won't get my surname right. So why don't we just say go to the Liquid Strategies website, which is www.liquidstrategies.com, and you'll find all our details there. You can email us from there and call us, and that's probably the best way.
All right.
So again, www.liquidstrategies.com.
Okay. Thank you, guys. I appreciate your time this morning. And for our listeners, we certainly appreciate you spending some time with us. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.